There's no shame in fear, my father told me. What matters is how we face it.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched with a second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast. Snow ditty for you.
Is that from which book? Let me guess. Is that from the third book?
I think so. I feel like he's trying to pep Sam up, if I remember right.
And if, yeah, then maybe it might be in book two. I don't know.
Ooh, might be. This time I was pulling it off of the cards rather than Search of Ice and Fire. So I did not have the exact reference in front of me this time.
Yeah, I mean, that could even be the first book, because there's not actually that many John and Sam scenes in the books after the second book, after John goes on his mission.
I must have phrased something a little off. There we go. It's actually in Clash. Found it just now.
Okay.
Yeah, it is definitely John trying to cheer Sam up. Interestingly, in Feast for Crows, Elaine basically quotes the exact same thing. Her father said there was no shame in being afraid, only in showing your fear.
Well, man, Martin recycling catchphrases. Wow, and speeches. That's like nipples on a breastplate. Words are will. Wind, rather.
Words,
will.
Words are will?
Words are will. Words are wind.
I love it. Tell you what, let's turn our attention back to the cards this week for episode 443 of the White Book. Whew. We creep ever closer to 450.
Yeah, ever closer, marching on. So this is entitled, the Night's Watch box is entitled, I just had it up.
What, Watchers on the Wall?
On the Wall. Watchers on the Wall, yep. This box, I'm going to say, is gas, as the young people would say. I think this box is very cool. I think there's some really powerful cards. And I think that it does, I think, a really good job of fleshing out themes. It almost does too good of a job, I guess you could say, of fleshing out themes that had barely existed before the box, making them extremely playable, aka builders, but also launching new themes that barely, like, could, I don't even know if you could make a Stewart's deck or there was any reason really to make a Stewart's deck, but the new gift really gives you a reason to do so in a way. I mean, we'll have to wait, I believe, until the next cycle, which we'll talk about next time we do this, is when the cook, can you smell what the rat is cooking, comes out. But,
Is that really a new theme, though? I mean, all the way back in the first cycle, right? Didn't they have the search event that let you pull one of the three traits?
But not specifically building around, like what did Stuarts – like, Stuarts had intrigue icons, right? Yeah. And builders – like, it was clear that, like, the first two themes, I think, had some pretty – you know, Rangers, excuse me – and builders had some pretty clear like signposts early on, you know, that they interact with the locations in the case of builders, right? There's a veteran builder in the core set. And then in the first cycle, there's whatever the builder is that reduces the cost of the first location you play each round. I've played builders a lot, but I cannot remember all of their names. Miscellaneous builders. I think,
it's almost that's as bad as
Power Matron. That's a really good one.
Of Greyjoys.
But yes, I think Builder, because the art is also interchangeable. Yeah. It's the same white dude with a giant beard and a gray sky doing something with the wall. Like, it's the same art over and over and over again. But anyway, you know, military icons with Rangers. Right. And the military challenge with Rangers were really clear, but Stuarts were really unclear in the core set. And I think up to this point, it wasn't super clear that like there was any point to playing a Stuarts deck. I mean, there wasn't a super big, the only one that really like made sense to play was Rangers, right? As like a theme deck itself up to the box, right? Because there was the event in the first cycle that murdered things, and the, you know, an aggression is always pretty good. It's baseline aggression is always playable in Thrones, right? Like clear your opponent's board somehow.
It's a default.
Yeah, you can just, you know, you can cobble together like an even win, you know, go 2-2 in a tournament or something doing that. But Stuart's like, I guess drawing cards, but even that's kind of in Sam, trying to think up to this point. Sam
Owen does it here, but Sam, yeah, here, Sam did previously. Sorry, Sam, I didn't realize you were going in the past at first.
Yeah, and then John, Core John, kind of was just a bad card. So and kind of supported Rangers. So, I don't know.
I mean, like, we definitely got stuff fleshed out. It's probably a minor quibble of mine that I'm not sure, to my definition, that this box really introduces new stuff to Night's Watch. To me, at least, the types of things we get here feels very different than, say, like the Lannister box, you know, where we get this big push into these new types of like rush and win by intrigue effects, or all this bouncing in and out kind of aggro-y clansmen stuff that hadn't existed before. The Night's Watch box feels to me like the whole thing is just, like you said, like just kind of giving the pieces needed to gel that stuff together and give you a reason to play the existing setup. I don't feel like it set up anything new for Night's Watch.
I mean, I guess where we disagree here, I just think it's Stuarts. I just think there was no reason to play a Stuarts deck before this box. I mean, weren't a lot of Stuarts, but I mean, they existed, but there was that core design decision to make the three traits, quote unquote, matter, which is something we could talk about, whether or not as like that's a theme that works, like the specific tribal, to use that term, works with Night's Watch. But whether or not that like traits mattering as a general theme really works, I don't think it ever has entirely come together for Night's Watch as like making like a real like a deck that really pays you off for having the right splattering of them, you know, for their own sake. I think that that's kind of just always been outside the reach of Night's Watch as a faction. Like the Valerian
doesn't count, you don't think?
No, but I mean, like, I'm not talking about the tribal deck where that's all builders, all Rangers. I'm talking about having like
mixed ones.
10 Rangers, 6 Stuarts, 4 builders. And there's a reason that you want one of all of them. Like the closest was the Valerian Steel build that Wama kind of like pushed that was playing the 3-cost event that later comes out that lets you search for one of each. But like your count of like certain ones was so low that, you know, it was, you were kind of like tutoring for John and getting, and John and Halder, and then I don't know, you're getting a Ranger for, I don't know, there was a Rangers in the deck for reasons, you know, because some decent Night's Watch cards had the Ranger trait. There was no like reason really you wanted a Ranger. It was just nice to have that third card. You know, do you see what I'm trying to say there, Will?
Okay. Yeah. No. I think I do get you that the mix never came together. Only the very
narrow.
The very narrow, very defined paths. I gotcha. So, which basically means that Night's Watch, especially from this box's release on, really sort of bifurcated, trifurcated. Is that a word? Into like three sub factions that were
more than that.
Well, maybe. I mean, yes, there's individual decks and stuff, but I mean, like, it became fairly clearly builders and stewards and rangers, and those traits were much more of a focus all the way through after this, rather than just building a Night's Watch deck. You had to really watch what you were doing with those.
Yeah, I think that on one hand, after this box, I think you and I agree is after this box, Night's Watch became, I think, one of the deepest factions in sort of the diversity of themes that were competitively playable. But I think that the card base of each one of those was very narrow. And it was very distinctive in a way that I think that for other factions is not the case. Particularly once you get into character bases, and once you, there's some cards like Banished Stronghold that really pushed Night's Watch, and then later Yorin. But, you know, for a long time, you know, the Stewart's deck kind of ran entirely Stewart's, and later Rat Cook, right? You needed so many Stewards to make Rat Cook good that you were going to banner Wolf for three more Stewards, right? like that. And then builders, like, notoriously there's gigantic fights among builders players and more casual players about like the specific sweet spot for builders. I was always on the side of you needed a lot of builders, other people weren't, but there was that debate. It was really important. Rangers was kind of the one that was a little bit more open about that, but, you know, there were so many military icons for Night's Watch concentrated on, you know, just that trait, that it just kind of naturally happened. And then the Steal Your Stuff deck, which kind of sometimes overlapped with Stewart's, but for a long time, the most competitive version of it didn't really play the Stewart stuff, you know, had a completely different base of cards. So it's, Night's Watch is weirdly a very diverse faction after this box. Even if the specific diversity is set on like a narrow specific number of cards that make it so diverse. If that makes sense.
Somewhat. Yeah. I'm kind of curious why that seems, now I forget your exact phrasing, but why that seems unusual. Is it just because you feel the previous boxes before this, didn't, fulfill that goal quite as well, that Wolves mm-hmm. and Lions didn't bring the same sort of expansive like new deck possibilities?
Yeah, I think for a long time until Yorin and really until the end of the game, Yorin, that last cycle, Yorin, oh my god, what's the two drop red green don't get to attack, Maester Mullen, there we go. And came out. I think pure good stuff Night's Watch kind of, what's the way I'm trying to say this? There was a lot less of it than in other factions. I think that other, you know, this box succeeds in saying like, okay, here's the Stewart cards, here's the Builders cards, here's the Rangers cards. And there's many fewer cards in here that are just good stuff in every Night's Watch deck. So like Tyrell is a great example of this, or Lannister at its peak, right? Was, oh. You know, there's a lot of different like Lannister decks out there. You know, there's Banner Rose and Banner Dragon and, you know, Banner Watch. You know, there was, you know, Banner Stag. There's Mono Knight Lannister. But, you know, 40 of the cards were the same, you know, in those decks, even if their gameplay was pretty different and could be, and, you know, and their basic game plans could be different. The power level of the Lannister cards, and Tyrell was another faction like this at its height. There's a bunch of different Knights, Tyrell decks based around Mace. You know, they 30, you know, maybe 20 cards would change, but there were still 40 cards that were the same across. And those 20 cards had a big impact, but you still were seeing so much of the same Tyrell card pool. That's not really the case with Night's Watch, right? You could play Builders one round and Stewart's next round and see a lot of different cards, particularly in the character bases. And that's what I think is where this box is successful.
Okay. Well, if let's start maybe dialing things down to look at some of those successful or unsuccessful cards in the box, with articles at this point being more vague than they were to start with. We don't have that to go off of the same way. How should we tailor our look at some of these Night's Watch cards? Should we take a look at what it brings to the table for each of these traits in order, or something like the little nod we get let's see, don't we get a very small nod at the whole choke aspect here? Could have sworn I saw something and then I looked past it.
I mean,
yeah, maybe we don't.
There are any choke cards in here, because choke kind of shifted to Greyjoy after a while, and then for like the middle part of the game, and then it kind of went back to Night's Watch, right? Because they printed what was it that like reduced their reserve, reduce their initiative card in like
second floor? Yeah, the winter location one.
Yeah, I don't think there's any choke.
Dang, I can't.
I'm just scrolling through here.
Yeah, I think when I first scrolled by real fast, I think I had misread the new gift or had forgotten exactly what the Queen's Crown did, which seems silly. I mean, to some extent, that could be used as a choke-ish card.
Sort of. I mean,
it's a pretty janky way to get to it.
Yeah. If it, yeah. I think, so I guess we should talk about the 500-pound elephant in the room, which is Builders. Builders was the most influential deck to come out of this box. It took the game kind of by storm in a weird way. I think Builders was never really played as much as it should be. That was Glazer's classic argument about Builders. But it did warp the meta entirely around itself. And it existed, particularly at first, I think Builders had a really useful role in the meta because it attacked the game on an axis that many of the top decks at the time were not prepared to deal with. And I think that was really good for the game. But definitely Builders had frustrating play patterns, a lot around the card that here is Castle Black Mason, because Castle Black Mason sort of kind of makes it so that they never run out of gas, and that it can, you know, can constantly be finding its key pieces that it needs to create the lock, alongside, of course, Abandoned Stronghold, which, you know, is not the flashiest card. And a lot of people, you know, don't quite understand, I think, how important Abandoned Stronghold is to Builders. But it is such an important play payoff card for the deck. And is alongside, I think, it and Castle Black Mason are the two cards in this box that really just make the deck such a smooth, powerful machine that it is. Really, I mean, it is playable up to present. Like, Builders remains a respectable deck, even if there are more answers to it in the meta now. And there, but it is definitely the big monster in the room.
It is key, I think, that you mentioned the kind of fuel cards, and then said specifically this box, because whenever I'm thinking about this box and Builders in a larger sense as well, I can't help but think of a card from the first cycle, little ditty you might have heard of called Brandon's Gift. And to some extent, I can't help but be fascinated by and kind of chuckle at how much of the push of this box feels to some extent like a direct, what am I looking for here? Like a direct pushback against the meta and the kind of wide-reaching disdain for something like specifically Brandon's Gift was essentially a meme in the community, right? I mean, I know we reviewed it poorly, and it was brought up many times as such a terrible card for so long because it was such a weird, narrow application without anything hardly to trigger it and so on. And then it really felt like this box was like, hey, yeah, we heard what you were saying, so here's how you make one of those old cards really good.
Yeah. And like, I mean, because the thing that Builder suffered from, right, and why you could, it was really easy to underrate Brendan's Gift, and I certainly did as well, is that, you know, there were just no Builders in the card pool. Like, you know, there was Veteran Builder and Halder, you know, who were good, but not particularly Halder, who was a powerful Night's Watch card from the moment he was printed. But there was no real reason to, you know, and then again, another really good Builder is printed in Shadow Black Mason, which we talked about previously as well. And you should definitely go back to our discussion about that card where we talk about a lot of Builder stuff, if memory serves well. But there still wasn't a reason to go all in on Builders, right? I mean, again, there was 6 playable Builders at that time, you know, nine cards you could play, right? So you could play 3 Castle Black Mason, 3 Shadow Black Mason, 3 Veteran Builder, 3 Halder, and that was kind of it. And then, oh, there's the reduced locations one.
Yeah, Swarm Brother. Okay.
Swarm Brother. There we go. You got it that time. So, but there wasn't really a Night's Watch location that you wanted to reduce. So basically you have this deck that's kind of existed before this box, but it was just spinning its wheels, right? It kind of could be a wall deck if you wanted it to be, but there was no specific reason to go so hard in on Builders because there was nothing here. And then Abandoned Stronghold just gives you a reason to go all in on those Builders and gives you a concrete payoff that lets you to actually win challenges on the defense. Which is super useful for a defense deck to threaten that. Or even if you don't win, you force your opponent to overcommit into a challenge to get a futile win. So, you know, they have to go all, you know, okay, it's a crossing deck that needs to win all 3 challenges. But to do that, it has to just like throw all these characters into a challenge it doesn't like because of the Abandoned Stronghold. And that prevents them from, you know, doing the intrigue or the power challenge last and getting their superior claim off, which gives you 2 more, you know, an additional turn, right? Abandoned Stronghold just gives you so much additional play because it, you know, really changes the dynamic for a lot of where defense was at that time, where you could start winning challenges and on the defense consistently and create basically a lock, right? A Builder's deck, I think up to this point, most defense decks couldn't really like lock an opponent out of winning the game, but Builders definitely could pretty easily. Like, you know, a good Builders player could have it set up with a decent draw, could get it set up by turn 2, You know, if they knew their sequencing right. And, you know, that's a very frustrating experience because it means that because wall decks are not fast decks to win, particularly as someone who's played builders at a lot of competitive events. It's the kind of deck that causes your opponent to naturally, I think most opponents naturally just slow down and try to figure out how they can get out of the trap that they're in. And, you know, you, their opponent, can say, like, look, person, you can't get out of this. But they don't, they're not under any obligation to believe you. And so they will sit. And, you know, I've lost many games to time playing builders because, you know, I had inevitability, but I didn't of power gain, but I didn't have inevitability of time. I couldn't do it in 55 minutes because my opponent needed, you know, 35 of it to figure out, you know, how not to do anything in a challenges phase. And that's a frustrating experience for both players. Like, that's actually one of the reasons why I kind of started to shy away from playing builders at competitive events was I was tired of going to time all the time.
I think a key aspect of that, that you're kind of leaning into there is part of why I feel that the defense decks as they came out was poor design implementation, that I think that's not a good path for a game like Thrones to go down, because it's not a combo in the truest sense of what people are used to thinking about from, say, a game like Magic, right? And I think that it is a control deck, but it, in the context of Thrones, in a lot of ways, it is the closest, like, acceptable combo adjacent thing, right? In that it is using a combination, pardon me for not having a different word ready at the top of my head here, of cards to accrete a board position that plays to a maybe not wildly different, but a different goal and state than the standard rules of the game actually play to. If you're looking at something like Magic, yes, your combo decks are still trying to create some kind of lock, but then as a general rule, right, then they smash face with some sort of beat stick and end the game through traditional combat most of the time. Or you have an actual full-on combo deck in Thrones where, yeah, it's kind of dirtling around doing its own thing and playing at kind of a sideways goal from the traditional goal. But then if it goes off and does its thing, like if it gets the right cards in the right order for that combination, the game is just over. The defensive Thrones decks are in this weird mashup of those two goals where it's trying to assemble the pieces and then it's hitting into it's hitting a target that is kind of sidestepped from the traditional Thrones goal. And then you just sit there and wait. It doesn't immediately reach its endpoint. It doesn't accelerate toward its endpoint. It just stymies the opponent. And then you sit and wait. And I think that's why so many people, it has rubbed wrong over the years. And honestly, why I think it's not a good place for a game like Thrones. Not in this form anyway.
So here's where I disagree with you, Will. If we're going to go with the Magic analogy, it is a control deck that uses a card like the 5-mana Teferi to win. Okay, which
everyone loves those too.
I'm not saying that people love them, Will. I'm just saying that it's not, because at the end of the day, like, Builders does play Honest Thrones in the sense that it's not gaining its power. It's not gaining, to me, what makes a Thrones combo deck is that it gains that 15 power in a way that is extremely narrow and extremely difficult for your opponent to interact with, and does so very rapidly. right? And that's where Ladies comes from. That's where Hyper Viper comes from. That's where Wonder Woman comes from. That's in many ways like where Mace can come for, or Fat Cat. It's gaining a giant chunks of power all at once in a way that minimizes your opponent's interaction. At the end of the day, Builders isn't really that, as you pointed out. It is, you know, in many ways, you know, no different than a Chamber and Chair deck, right? It has a location accelerant, but that accelerant is two additional power at the end of the challenges phase that can be interacted with your opponent. Now, at the end of the day, the defense tools could become too powerful and create a lock, but it was not, you know, there were still points of interaction with that lock. Like, people could get out of a Builder's lock. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes you could force the Builder's player to Valor themselves or whatever. We don't need to go into specific things, but that's where I feel like why I've – this is a hill I will die on. Glazer and I literally screamed at each other on this show about this, is that Builders is a control deck. The reason – so control players like Glazer don't like that because they don't like Builders, because it, you know, plays on a somewhat different axis. It does, you know, have a game plan that is, you know, unusual for Thrones, even if it is playing within the challenges. And, you know, lots of people don't like the playstyle of Builders, a perfectly reasonable thing. They don't like their beloved Martell and Targaryen control decks to be lumped in with the Nemesis Builders, you know, and so they slap, well, what's the biggest insult you could throw at a deck type, a play style in Thrones, and in many games as well. Magic is frequently like this as well, is combo. And I mean, I think particularly in our game, like the death word of our game is combo. And if a deck can get stuck with the label combo, you know, people start to get upset and want cards restricted and banned and all that kind
of stuff. That's true. And whether it truly is or not. But that also gets into some of the weirdness of the way Thrones operates mechanically. Mm-hmm. It has been hard for some of those common terms to have a strict application to Thrones.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to be really generous, it's a combo control deck, right? It's a control deck that gets to the point where it can execute its combo finisher, which you could all see by scare quotes around it.
A slow, pingy, dirtily finisher.
Yes. But I think
it's like killing somebody with, what's the super old artifact? Blasting Rod, is it?
That's way beyond my knowledge of magic.
Something like that. It was like pay three and tap it, deal one damage to a player.
That would be very slow.
It's that.
Yes, it is like that in many ways. And I think it's clear that, you know, Builders probably got like too pushed. But I think going back to the metagame, I do think it was a very healthy injection into the metagame. For a while, I think it got, I think the Builders took a while for people to figure out how to beat it. And once it did, I think it became a useful pillar of the metagame, where there were some metas that were extremely hostile to Builders. And then the meta would get soft to Builders, and somebody like Derek Shoemaker would bring Builders to a tournament, and he would roll people. And then if you tried to go to the next big tournament with Builders, people were ready for it, right? As soon as people remembered that Builders was a deck, they were suddenly ready for it, and they knew the play patterns, they knew how to beat it. But then they would get complacent and, you know, lazy, and Builders would come back and punish them for that. And I think that was one of the cooler things about the deck's place in the metagame. Yeah.
There we go.
I do think that this, particularly, I think the card that ended up being, I think, probably overpushed was Castle Black Mason is too good. Because it did eventually start seeing play outside of Builder's decks as just like a good stuff Night's Watch card towards the end of once we get Valyrian Steel, and there's, you know, a real need for this ability to fetch attachments. I think if Castle Black Mason had been printed a little less efficiently, because CBMs with a practice blade, you know, can get some work done, let me tell you. even when they're not searching stuff up. Like a 4 for 4 is remarkably good. It doesn't get hit by First Snow, the frequent enemy of builders decks. And again, with a practice blade, it actually becomes a 5 or 6 strength if you have the wall out. Bicon. So if it had been maybe like 4 for 2, it might have been a little bit of, I think the builders would not have been as strong.
No, I agree. The stat line comes out pretty good. 4 for 2, I think, would be pretty reasonable. I was about to also say like 3 for 2 to be in first snow range, and then I remembered he's just a straight up action.
Yes.
So you could still get a
jet balance action that also probably would have been better.
Yeah, I for some reason had it in my head that it was challenges till I stopped to read it again. I was like, oh wait a minute,
It's most frequently either a marshalling or dominance action.
Oh yeah, I mean marshalling, so you can just play stuff, which also I think to some extent goes to illustrating some of this design perspective shift. Where in the early sets, I forget now how much we really hit on this in our early retrospectives. I feel like we did at least a little in the core set, where draw and card advantage was very carefully micromanaged by the design team to push it into later phases of the game. So that most cards are not immediately usable when you draw them or search them out or whatever. If Castle Black Mason had been a core set card, he would 100% be a challenges or dominance action straight up. No.
He's most balanced as a challenges action because the ability to keep him up until dominance and then start triggering them in dominance. So you get them, for defense. If you need them, they count for you, and then they count for dominance. Yeah, anyway.
Right. Well, and it's vulnerable to intrigue then if you happen to go ahead and use his ability before the intrigue challenge comes through, things like that.
Yep.
Yeah. But. So that's another way the game has accelerated as cards have been released, that careful watch on card advantage has drifted.
Yeah, that's true. And it's another thing. I think the reason for that was just they missed in some crucial factions about card draw. And once you miss and it all gets kind of broken, it's really hard to put the genie back in the bottle. So you just sort of start needing to give everybody genies, if that makes sense. That's a kind of a bad metaphor.
Or I get where you're going.
About card draw. And I think I definitely said this on the show multiple times, is my experience as a card game player and following, multiple different card games, balancing your card game around the availability of card draw for certain factions, and then saying like this faction's advantage is it gets to draw cards. This faction's disadvantage is it has trouble gaining draw cards is really, really dangerous. It's playing with fire because, drawing cards is probably the most, besides winning the game itself, drawing cards is probably the most fun thing for players to do in card games. Hey, you have a deck of all these shiny cards that you spent money on. Don't you want to play them and draw them and play them? Like, designers kind of start being like, well, what, players want to draw cards. Well, they should draw cards. And it just easily starts spiraling. And of course, when you have an effect that you want to push, you frequently, what's the easiest way to push an effect? It's slap draw a card on it, right? And so I just think that there's this danger when you tightly balance things around card draw, because as soon as it gets out of control, and it's really hard to put that genie back in the bottle. And that definitely happened with Thrones. I think it's a little bit later than this that it really gets out of control. I think it's maybe the Wyman is in the first Shadow cycle, right? If I remember,
is he in gosh, which
the next cycle we're going to talk about.
Let's see. I think it's Wyman is in the March on Winterfell, which is, yeah, second pack of the first Shadow Cycle.
Okay, yeah. I think it's at that point that Draw truly starts to get out of control. And all the faction, it feels like every faction except Lannister is drawing a billion cards at all times. And really, the necessity of like counting coppers, unless you're playing Lannister, really, that's where you start seeing the fall of the rise of free card draw is the fall of counting coppers. And I think you really see that. We'll see that maybe a little bit more clearly, maybe in the next two or so of these that we do. Once we get, oh, and then the Martell box, let's not forget Dorne.
Ooh, that's going to be fun.
That's a big turning point. So I think we've talked a lot about builders. One more builders note. I think if they had made Abandoned Stronghold a named Night's Watch location and it was unique, that also would have been a good balancing point. Because getting two of these babies out, much less three, is sweet.
What about something like, well, honestly, we spent a little bit of time on stewards as well, talking about how unfocused they had been. But, you know, we haven't talked at all about rangers, hardly. And I definitely recall a rangers with our favorite recurring agenda, Lord of the Crossing deck, coming to bear after this box.
It definitely was. I think that was when Mira got squeaked in into the top 16 at Gen Con. That was the year this box came out, right? Yeah.
I think so. 2017. Yeah. Because this box came out
playing in winter, Rangers.
And there was some Rangers that made the rounds a little bit in store championships. I feel like they were winter that year.
And I played builders that summer. And that was kind of its breakout performance. Wama and Florian won some tournaments. I did pretty well in a couple of tournaments playing it. And then the meta actually became a little hostile to builders. And so we switched over to playing Night's Watch Reigns using this Jon Snow, who is my favorite card in the entire box, by the way. I think he's one of the best design 7 drops in the game. And I believe that's when Mira beat Kyle, right?
Maybe, could be.
Right, when Kyle was King of Swiss, and then the start time drama. That was 2017. So that was, I think, the first Gen Con that this was legal. It definitely was, because we almost played that. Scott ended up playing the bad Night's Watch stag deck that Glazer almost convinced all of us to play. And that was with Bestow cards and the Night's Watch box and no Martell box cards. So, Rangers was pretty good. Rangers always classically having been on, I think, so I was on JND 2, it's Night's Watch team, and I was on the Winning Thrones War team. Rangers is always a deck that's like almost always just almost not there. Like, it's just barely there, right? Like, it's okay, but never quite amazing. Do you know, Will? Like, and you really see that in these cards here. Like, there's some really powerful ones, like Sir Jeremy Riker, give everybody a power icon. Gren and Pip, right, are pretty good. But the deck just, like, never quite had the oomph to really consistently be a force in the meta.
I think it has a fairly straightforward put together like package, right? Like, here is your Rangers aggro deck, enjoy. And like we had said before, aggro kind of just to some extent always has a place in Thrones, the way the nature of the board state and challenges are in Thrones, that these aggressive pressure decks always kind of become a default measurement of everything else, if nothing else. But the Rangers, if you compare that to something like, say, Dothraki, Targ, Sea of Blood stuff, the Rangers never got the truly bonkers pieces that they don't have their womb of the world or whatever, right? Like, yeah, sure,
Jeremy Riker is their womb of the world.
Yeah, they don't have that equivalent. Yeah, they've got like Jon Snow, which maybe loosely I'm going to equate to, you know, Drogo in strength and effectiveness and home in the deck and whatever. But they don't have the really bonkers stuff that put it over the top.
But the most consistent Rangers decks were not running Jon Snow. The card that was kind of their cowl Drogo was the non-unique three drop that couldn't block. But didn't kneel
to attack.
Yeah, that one could get out of hand. Pretty. That was kind of its like payoff piece. That's a little later. I think that's maybe in the next set, or maybe it's in the beginning of Shadows. I think the problem Night's Watch, like Rangers, was always fine. It was always playable. Like you could take it to the deck and expect, you know, you could maybe sneak into a cut. You could, you know, have a positive win record, but there was just always better aggro decks. Okay, so like the era of this box, the best aggro deck was Targ Crossing, which gets, of course, one of its most iconic Targaryen cards is in this box, Plaza of Pride, which I didn't realize it was so late that Plaza of Pride came out. Like, I feel like I've been playing this card since
forever.
But it's definitely probably the most busted card besides Abandoned Stronghold in this and Builder at the Wall in this box.
It's worth, as far as timeline goes, I mean, this is basically smack dab in the middle of the second ed lifespan, right? So you have been having to face off against it for quite a while.
It just feels longer, I guess. But I was playing, probably the most second edition I played was from slightly before this box came out to the end of 2018. So it was like this 2-year period was probably the most that it was like playing Thrones. So okay, like where I was playing almost every night on Iron Throne, and we were really taking off with our team, and my best tournament results were from 2017 to 2018 as well. So, yeah. So
perfect.
It does. You're willing to drive yourself up or down the East Coast conveniently, going to a lot of tournaments conveniently is good practice. I think we should hold off on talking about Stuart's really in depth until we get to Rat Cook, which I think is a little while, because that's the card that really, really pushes you. But the new gift would definitely be my award-winning sleeper card of the set. It was very similar. You and I reviewed the first set of these cards and then you reviewed the locations with Alex Black, I believe. Half of it with Alex Black. Notoriously, you guys panned Abandoned Stronghold.
We did. I honestly think it was holdover from the meme that was Brandon's gift at the time. We were blinded to Abandoned Stronghold.
What? Yeah, because when did this come out? Did it come out like right? I feel like it came out like right when I moved to Philly, or shortly thereafter in 2016, at the end of 2016, and because I remember we were actually really happy when you panned Abandoned Stronghold, because Wama had the builder's car, the deck. He and Florian had were the first draft of it was they were passing around, and I was extremely grateful when they let me be one of their playtesters for it and be able to take it to a regional. And Wama was just very happy that you panned Abandoned Stronghold, because it meant that people would just be ignoring the builder's cards, and he wanted the free equity. But I think the new gift, if I remember right, I think the new gift screams much more than Brandon's gift does about, like, play Stuart's, because it says explicitly draw a card, right? Like, on it. And you're kind of like waiting for enough, like another Stuart payoff, right? Like, if Rat Cook had been in this box, we would have had Stuart's from the go, right? Like, the important thing about this box is it gave two really, well, actually more than that, because there's also Grizzle Miner in here, but there's at least two busted builders in this box alone. Stuart's kind of gets just, it gets, what's his face? Pip. No, not Pip. Satin, who's really good in that deck. But explicitly just by Stuart's, probably just the new gift is probably like the only like super ridiculous card that they get here. It's going to take Rat Cook to really push it, and we should talk a little bit more about what Rat Cook does.
When we get to it, or go ahead and talk it now. Okay.
I mean, we could. I mean, it did cause our – we almost lost Kyle forever because of
that deck. We got so close. I don't know if we have time to go down that rabbit hole. I think when we hit it in the appropriate cycle, then we'll get
to talk about that story, which is one of my favorite Kyle. There's so many great Kyle stories, but Kyle's reaction to losing to – getting cooked by the rat is – I think about it all. It really is. If I need a good chuckle, if I'm having a long day at work, I think about Kyle and Rat Cook, and I can't help but laugh and smile.
Yeah. You just keep coming back to that. It's good. It's good. What else do we keep coming back to in this box? Have we mined pretty much all of the Night's Watch cards?
I think we've hit most of the important ones. Like, I mean, some other standout ones we haven't super talked about. Queen's Crown. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that when we get to the new wall.
Yeah, we didn't hit on the kind of thieving theme at all. That's a fair point. And there are several cards for that theme here. Not only Queen's Crown, but stuff like Now My Watch Begins.
I tried so hard with Queen's Crown before New Wall came out. I played so many bad Queen's Crown decks, Will.
Yeah. I mean, it's an efficient, low cost, not quite Fate Seal. There we go. That's the term I was trying to remember. Not quite Fate Seal kind of card. But yeah, you need more pieces to really put this together. It is demoralizing for the opponent, even by itself, though, even before you get a payoff card for it, watching your, you know, Tywins or whatever hit the bin is demoralizing in a game.
It is. It is. And well, it's demoralizing until you realize that the steel cards are all bad. It takes 1 million gold. It takes for them to steal your Tywin before the new wall comes out. So, you know, it takes like what, minimum 8 gold, because you have to pay the locate. You have to pay for the event in the second cycle, right? Is it the second cycle that at Night Gathers comes out? Is like that
3 cost one?
No, the 1 cost one. The one that you can play out of your opponent's discard pile.
Oh yeah, yeah. Where you just play it? Yes, yeah.
So that's 1 gold. Then they have to have 7 for Tywin, and you're like, okay. And you have to have higher reserve than your opponent. So you have to...
Reserve matters, Roy. Reserve matters.
Yes. Well, the thing, of course, right? The balancing there is, you know, the expensive, the high gold plots are low reserve. So it's hard to, you know, time it properly. So anyway, Night Gathers was not as good as I lost a lot of games playing Queen's Crown Knight and Gather's decks. That's all I'm trying to say here, Will. And then the new wall came out and it all changed. For Night's Watch cards, also Ghost is also like a remarkably good card that I think people really learned how good it was when the Valerian Steel came out. Related to that, of course, is another sleeping giant, Seasons Woodman, who, you know, never was good enough for the Builder's deck, because the Builder's deck was never really about putting a huge amount of attachments on your own characters. There was the Practice Blades, but that was kind of it. So it wasn't really worth it to play Seasons Woodman. Some of them did. Sandy was always a big believer of this card when he was playing Builders a lot. Same with Scott. But like it was, the Euros, Wama and Florian were never big fans of it. So it was kind of like a little bit like you could see the potential of it, but it really required like a reason to go all in on the miscellaneous Night's Watch attachments. And of course, Florian Steel is just a Danny design, right? Or is it? It's a Corey design. Sorry, Cohors is Florian. You needed something like Valerian Steel to make you go all in on the attachment. So we'll come back to Seasons Woodman and how busted he is at the end of our retrospective. Valerian Steel, but he's definitely a sleeping giant here.
Oh man. What else is a sleeping giant? I'm just ready to move on from Night's Watch to the other houses. I find myself, it's no secret that Night's Watch has long been my least favorite of the quote houses, end quote, for a multitude of
factions.
Yeah, there we go. For a multitude of flavor-based reasons. But I feel like this box also really brought some interesting and strong cards to some of the other factions. Saltwife had some strong use, particularly became a melee staple immediately. Southron Messenger became a Martell staple. Notice I'm already going straight to cards that can be abused with Flea Bottom.
Oh yeah, the Salt Wipe Flea Bottom.
God. Yeah, Plaza of Pride, like you said, really became a targ staple.
Jane Poole, she also remains weirdly played a lot for a long time because she's the 2-for-1 bicon with the right icons for Stark. Mm-hmm. The only faction that, look, besides Night's Watch, of course, that I think hit it out of the park is we're starting to see the beginning of the era of nonstop good green cards, Will, because both of these green cards are hits.
They're not like slam dunk, always run threes in the decks,
they're
workhorses, I think.
Honeywine, it was a staple for a long time of. They're both staples for a long time of the crossing deck. Fossway kind of just saw play sometime in mace decks because you wanted, he was efficient, right? 4-for-4, right. Sometimes renown.
And you needed some military icons in the mace decks.
Yes, you did. And sometimes you needed disposable, like intrigue icons you were willing to risk in challenges.
Yeah.
Because you definitely weren't putting Mace in challenges because he could get popped back the hand by a Sothron Messenger or other nonsense. Mm-hmm. I think each faction here I think this is a pretty balanced non-core faction box. Like even Lannister got a playable card
off faction.
Off,
is that maybe
like not Night's Watch, right? Like
right, no. I was just offering alternate names for how we could express that,
right? Because Black Bertha saw play, and so did Myra. She can be really annoying when she gets going. Mm-hmm.
If you've got the money to spend, I feel like she hit right when Barra was still struggling for some of that income. But I do remember seeing some weird, janky...
Greyjoy Stag.
Yeah. Greyjoy Stag Intimidate stuff that she got played in.
Oh, yeah. Asha, stealth the person, kneel the person, draw a card. Yeah, she can be real annoying in those Greyjoy decks. Black Betha saw some play, remains like a popular Shaga card. Saltwife definitely saw a lot of play. Some people really love Raiding the Bay of Ice. Ulf was definitely playable and one of the better Clansmen cards. Southern Messenger was really good. Lingering Venom, solid. Jane Poole saw play. Positive Pride saw a lot of play, and both of the Tyrell cards saw solid amounts of play. So I think this was this box, I think, is great value for players. One of the reasons why I was so impactful in the meta, because like 7 out of the 8 factions got decks that could cards that could go into decent decks. You could say, if you're being less generous, 6 out of 8, which hits a lot more than the other, I think, than the other boxes that we talked about.
I think so. Yeah. I feel like there were more I guess I could take a look at them again real quick, but I do feel like there were more factions that were just like flat misses in those factions. Yeah, comparatively so. Or at least they kind of need more pieces. Yeah.
And everybody's 3 favorite Free Folk cards are in this box as well.
Yeah, there's a solid neutral contingent here, whether you're playing Free Folk or, I saw other random decks running Rattleshirt just for a reasonable attacker.
Oh yeah. Mike Aruro's Greyjoy, what was the, you don't play non-loyal card. You only play non-loyal cards, but you get to pick a keyword. It was like the first shot at Free Folk.
The Brotherhood Without Banners.
Without Banners, which I believe is in the next pack next cycle we're gonna talk about, I think, right?
The
funny thing is, shows you though, like these 3 cards are all really busted. Rattleshirt, Dala, and Crow Killers. And it's surprising to me that really they still weren't good enough to compete with the in-faction stuff until Free Folk. Like, Dala is like a really strong card.
Oh, yeah. The instant I saw that, like, she is just an engine.
And, you know, she, deck, you know, we didn't see that many really competitive wildling decks. You're definitely right that, like, Rattleshirt saw play in some decks built around Put, some decks that put around unopposed challenges, like Mike's deck was for Greyjoy, very much all about. It also had Saltwife well. But they just really didn't see, and you sometimes saw Crow Killers sometimes in crossing decks, but they just didn't really take really 3 just busted cards just really didn't see consistent play until Free Folk, which I think shows you again just how weak the neutral card pool is overall in second edition. I think they did overall do a better job in second edition of not printing particularly characters that were neutral and sort of like omnipresent. Probably the closest was ever the 2 for 2 kneels to your opponent's faction card, Shadows guy. What's his name?
Crud. He's a mercenary. Old Bill Bone.
Oh, Bill Bone. Bony boy. Yeah, get boned. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably the closest they've come to like how how over the top neutral cards were in first edition, particularly neutral characters.
Yeah, I could see that.
So, want to talk real quick about plots?
Yeah, this one is a weird realm for plots. I feel like these are more kind of experimental design space than we have been seeing before. Especially something like the introduction of the white shadows really feels like trying to push the envelope of what a plot could do. It didn't really pan out as being competitively playable in the end, but it is at least some kind of weird, interesting Shaga-y design space to play in.
It's also an attempt at a Ned plot. Like, not a lot of plots are Nedly or theme wins, but the White Shadows is a shot at that, and I think it's relatively successful. I think the problem I feel like the White Shadows has is this, like, it requires just so much enabling that it's really just hard, even for a Shaga player, to like really get a lot of, well, really paid off for it. You know, like even a Shaga player has to jump through not one, not two, but sometimes like three hoops to be able to do anything interesting with this card. You know, because like you can't Valor Morghulis at the same time you're White Shadowing or something, right? I feel.
Yeah,
which I think, again, I think shows why you frequently don't see effects like this on plots, because just of the way these kind of effects on plots are just really hard to build around, even for players who are trying to go all in.
It is, however, one I know a handful of folks have done events like this in the past. We did one here, even if the format didn't catch on, you know, like wildfire, so to speak. But in a 2v2 or two-headed giant or whatever you might want to call that format, you can do some neat things with something like White Shadows where your teammate can reveal that necessary valor that you mentioned. So there is some space that can still be played and explored in some of these alternate formats. So I do still like that. It's something.
Yeah. I think also the fact if it had been until end of round and it could be a cool, like, valor answer, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, your opponent is going to valor or melee, like, you know, playing around someone, you know, playing around resets. It could be cool. Like, if it was until end of the round, it would have been cooler, but I'm sure much more easily broken. So I guess there was an attempt to rein it in here. Fire That Burns is a big of a trap card. It's never was good outside of Night's Watch Reigns. But retail in second edition, I mean, for first edition players, this was one of the most ubiquitous plots by the end of first edition, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah. No downside at all, except for the fact that it used one of your seven slots.
Yes. But, and it was pretty popular until literally the next cycle. Like, I remember retail was like the 2K lane plot that was promised until Wind Die came out. Did we talk about Wind Die last time, or is that not until the end of?
I don't think we've gotten that yet.
Okay, so it might be the end of the Bestow cycle.
Yeah.
So I think the retail was kind of like really cool to claim design space, because I think they actually hit like on retail. I think it's a very balanced to claim plot in second edition. The four reserve is very brutal. And particularly the way in which retail, you know, sometimes you would open retail. Do you remember those decks in first?
Yeah. That is pretty nasty to do to yourself in second ed.
It really is. And even doing it turn two could be pretty brutal. So I think they hit. It was like, but they just sort of Windeye became it's just a better version of this. Like, let's just be honest. Like,
well,
5-8-0, draw two cards. You know, 5-8-2-0, draw two cards is much better than 4-8-2.
Yeah,
you know, you get to make your opponent first player, which of course a lot of the decks that play Windeye in second edition really don't want to go second. So
yeah, not to go too far down the road of analyzing you win or you die, but I think that was pushed way too far, and that retaliation is actually probably about the correct power point for this type of thing.
I agree. We are in agreement there, Will. We might want to mention real quick Last of the Giants, which was a big gift to control decks, traditional control decks, with the ability to Giants Varus.
I mean, and some janky combo stuff, too.
Yes, well, it was played in the combo decks, right? What's his face?
Mag the Mighty?
Mag the Mighty.
Yeah.
Mag the Mighty, yep. None of the other plots. Call to Service really tried too hard, but in the end, it didn't even matter.
Love the Linkin Park reference.
This deck card, we frequently tried so very hard in Mace decks to play Call to Service. It just was never that great. Good alternate art card, though. Great alternate art.
Gosh.
Bob, like, ripping up his being called in, like, by Joffrey. It's nice art. Like, I have, like, 500 of them from regionals. But,
Man, I wish I remember what the trick was. There was something one of our local players was doing back before lockdown with this in a Barra deck and some of the newer cards.
Was it using Conclave? Because you could definitely...
Maybe it was just using Conclave. It's been so long now since I could play in person that I legit can't remember.
Wama, I wonder if I still have it, actually, in my card game DB. It's not even put on this computer, my login information. Wama, I think, had it in his Star Conclave that he loved for a long time, that I almost played at that Worlds 2017, right? That's when Reinhardt won, right? It was 2017.
Oof, the years all blur together for me.
It was, 2016. Well, easy. Mirando and Trump won in 2016. Then it was Reinhardt. Then it was Leonard. Then Francis.
Okay.
So we're world champions. So yeah, I almost played that at the year Reinhardt won, because I remember playing some test games with Maddie in the hotel. And that didn't really quite land. So I don't think I have anything more to say about this, this box. Well,
yeah, I mean, I think we covered a lot of stuff in actually magically, mystifyingly, even faster than the two of us have done the last couple boxes. Maybe because the themes that this box does hit on, it seems to be much more laser focused in reinforcing those particular items. So maybe that's why discussion goes faster.
Well, we've also already talked about builders. Like, I think that's also because a lot of the things in this box are already ubiquitous in the way we think about the game. We've talked about builders a bunch when we talked about Shadow. I think we had two extended discussions of it when we got to Gift and when we got to Shadow Tower Mason in our first. So that would be like our third and fourth episode of doing this. And then a bunch of the other big Night's Watch stuff comes a little bit later down the line when you know, some of these Stuart cards pay off. So I think we gave the biggest takeaway of this box. I mean, what, we talked about builders for maybe 45 minutes, 35 minutes. So
a good chunk.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk more about Plaza of Pride and how it greatly enabled that Targ deck that ruled the game up to, I mean, led to the world, helped Reinhardt go, you know, Euro champion to world champion, right? Like that Targ efficient good stuff deck, Plaza of Pride was in many ways the key to that deck. Like I saw this card carry so many Targ players to victory. And it's just so efficient and helps with all their themes and, you know, standing Drogo with your second sons and paying one gold to, you know, get your second sons out. And yeah.
It's all of that action advantage, which we've talked about off and on in the retrospectives, notably in the talk about the beefy 6 and 7 cost characters, which go straight to Drogo, as you said. It loops in combos with Flea Bottom, which we've talked about. You know, the card advantage and efficiency there. It's just kind of the perfect intersection of all of those themes to be such a staple. And it's one cost. Mm-hmm. Drastically, wildly undercosted. This would have, I think, still seen probably just as much play at 3 cost.
Maybe not as much play at 3 cost.
Okay, maybe not as much, but it would have still been a very common choice at 3 cost.
I think 2 and reduce it to, you have to discard a 4 cost card to stand a, so raise the gold cost by 1, lower the X by 1, I think would be a good spot for this card.
Yeah, tweaking what you can stand with the discarded card does change a lot of the power level here.
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, if you just got rid of X is, you know, X is 3 higher and keep it at 1, so, like, you have to discard a Drogo dupe to stand Drogo, would right. also, I think, be interesting. I just think the card's just overpushed it, and just... you know, with the combination of Flea Bottom and then later Targaryen discard pile payoffs, you really, yeah, you just get, I get, again, one of the most ubiquitous cards in the game. And it's any faction, by the way, that you can stand the card. So that may, of course, ban Dragon, Landy Dragon.
Pause is non-loyal, so oof. Yeah.
Yep.
It became very common, particularly in Melee, for it really caused some issues.
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you also, you know, get Queen's Guard, I mean, I forgot that they printed a redundant version of this effect. Oh, my God. Yeah. Anyway, we had more to say because, again, you know, there are about 4 super busted cards in this pack. Oh, yeah. There's one more thing. I just want to dump my episode. Jon Snow, such a good design. Such a good design. Easily one of the best, sweetest spot. If all the 7 drops in the game were box Jon, the game would be so much better. So
I could get behind that. That would be very interesting. To see things at that level. I mean, you know, he's strong. He offers some interesting choices. He can be played around or tweaked. He pushes 2 different themes with some of those choices. I think there's a lot to like about it, his design.
Yeah, and you never hear people being like, "Oh man, Box John can run away with games," but you never be like, "Oh, I lost this game entirely because my opponent saw John." Like, all this game is about is whether or not my opponent sees John, right? Like, John was frequently, like, a closer. Like, John's really good at, like, finishing up a game that you're already, like, when you're at parity, pushing you ahead, right? And that's kind of where I think 7 drops really should be. Because, you know, like, John can sometimes be a really bad top deck if he has no supporting character, supporting cast. Because he's expensive, he doesn't have a power icon, he doesn't draw you cards. He does give you some action economy, but he has to win the challenge to give you the action economy. So, you know, it makes you think about the challenges. Anyway, I think this John is a really sweet spot. And I think in many ways, if folks don't know, like, how does Roy evaluate good seven drops? This John Snow was really there for me.
That's where you go. Well, cool.
And I do whine about seven drops a lot on the show.
Yeah, pushing things like seven drops was a big design goal for second edition. So I think it makes sense that we would keep coming back to it and talking about it more. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that covers the box. I think we call it a week.
Indeed. See you all next time.
See ya.
See ya.
You heard it here first, listeners. If you can get a hold of Roy's debit card, bam, you're in.
Yeah, could you actually edit that out? I'm sorry. Well, I was trying to meet myself, but I didn't have time. But it's actually not my debit card password.
No. Password. I was definitely going to edit that out.
Okay, cool. I appreciate that. Sorry.